importance of nursing research, quality of care, and health monitoring from home. Plus, we'll take a look at antifreeze poisoning. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'd like to welcome everybody to this week's program. We have a lot of exciting things coming up for you in the show this week, including another visit from our friend from Maryland Poison Control, and Lisa Booz is going to be joining us to talk a little bit later on about some of the things we might see from an accidental or even intentional overdose from antifreeze, and we'll be checking in on that a little bit later on. If you're a brand new listener to the show, and I know we have quite a few of you out there, I want to encourage you to make sure you head over to the Nursing Show website. You can find that at nursingshow.com. At that site, you'll find links in the show notes for each episode to everything we talk about, and that's important because I can give you some general medical information here or talk about a topic with someone like Lisa Booz, but I also want to make sure I provide you follow-up information so that you can find out exactly how to apply what I talk about here to your own nursing practice, or if you're a student, to your own student nursing practice. And that's important. You need to make sure that you follow up on that yourself. You can always get in touch with me as well by sending me an email to comments@nursingshow.com. Gotten quite a few great comments in via email, one of them from listener Samantha from Ohio, and she's currently a nursing assistant but is also attending school to become an LPN and is working on going forward to her RN next year, and just wanted to check in. And I just want to thank you, Samantha, for checking in and enjoying the show and responding. Make sure you send me any ideas for things you'd like me to cover, maybe some topic that you're having some difficulty with in school. We'll make sure we try to get that on the show here as soon as possible. If you have any comments or questions like Samantha, make sure you send them in yourselves. I've also heard in from other listeners, like listener Lily and listener Sonia, who checked in and left comments over on the Nursing Show site. And that's something all of you can do. If you're reading an article over there or even checking out the show notes at the bottom, you'll find a link there that'll allow you to leave your own response, your own comment. You can also click the Share This link and send a link to that to your Facebook page, to your MySpace page, or by email to a friend. So make sure you take and make use of those tools so that we can share this information with everyone else. If you're looking for other great medical podcasts, I have to remind you that The Nursing Show is a member of the ProMed Network at promednetwork.com. Professional medical podcasts from physicians, nurses, people like physical therapists, and others that are coming online all the time. So it's a great place for you to check in and find all kinds of great information in the medical marketplace. I'd also like to put out a call to anybody out there that happens to be involved with travel nursing or any kind of medical staffing business. It's been something that has cropped up on my radar a couple of times in the past few weeks, and I thought it might be an interesting interview to put in front of the listeners of the show to find out a little bit more about this type of nursing from facility to facility or area to area. So if you have a connection or somebody you can put me in contact with, that would be great, and you can send that into comments@nursingshow.com. I will lead off the news this week with a story on nursing research, and this kind of combines with a conversation I had a few days ago, with listener Rob, who is also a graduate nurse in Canada and is involved with putting together a podcast looking specifically at nursing research. And We're going to be working together on that. Hopefully, Rob will have his show up and running in the next few months. And when that happens, we'll definitely talk about it. But teaching more about nursing research, good methodology, and also looking at understanding and reading research articles, not just the reading the abstracts and reading the news releases on them, but helping all of us to understand a little bit more about what's going on in the methodology and what is important when we read that research. So we'll be looking at that. But this article I found out of the Royal College of Nursing in the UK talks specifically about some of the impacts that quality nursing research is having on patient care and on the quality of nursing in general in the UK and indeed worldwide. So you know, that's something we need to remember. And I talked a little bit about it, I think either last week or the show before that, we talked about the importance of good oral hygiene and oral care, and that a nursing research study found that doing oral care for your patients that were intubated and on a ventilator actually seemed, in a corollary effect, to reduce the incidence of pneumonia on these patients. And certainly that needs to be followed up on, but it shows that there can be significant impact from seemingly simple nursing interventions. And you know what? The only people who are going to do that kind of research are us. And so I urge you to check out this article. I urge you to look in your own community, talk to nursing schools in your area, if you're not in school right now, but talk to them about perhaps working on developing a program for existing nurses to learn more about producing research in their facilities and instituting some kind of study on patient care and the effects of patient care changes. I think this is an important step in the right direction for both improving patient care and improving the nursing profession. As we become busier and more and more strapped with additional patients and additional responsibilities, we need to find ways to improve the quality of our care without having to improve the time spent on our care. So we're going to have to start to divide and conquer and really prioritize. I mean, we all talk about prioritizing patient interventions, but wouldn't it be nice to know that this simple intervention is something that's going to have a bigger effect and need a higher priority than another simple nursing intervention? And these are things that we can do as nurses and nursing researchers. Expect me to do more on this and cover more on this. If you're involved in nursing research and would like to perhaps lend a short article on nursing research, on reading articles and reading nursing journal submissions, please let me know. I'd love to put that up on the site and make it available for all of the listeners, freely available on the site. So please get in contact with me. Next up, I found another story that comes out of Medical News Today, looking at how nurses are playing a role in improving nursing care. Now, this is from the December 2008 issue of Urologic Nursing. And in this particular article, they examined some of the Joint Commission's National Patient Safety Goals for things such as medication safety, communications, and general patient safety. And this article looks at the fact that nurses really are one of the most important roles in improving patient safety and the overall quality of patient care. This may not be a surprise to most of us, certainly it isn't to me, but it shows and provides some ammunition when the time comes for us to talk about nurse staffing in our facilities, when the time comes for us to look at our role in instituting policies in our facilities. If those policies are being put in place at an administrative level without any inclusion of nurses in the planning process, clearly that's not really going to do much to improve quality of care unless they've had nurses that are actively involved in patient care as part of the quality improvement process. So check out the link in the show notes for this particular article. Certainly provides a lot of good quality points to think on and to have in your back pocket when you need to bring something out and discuss it with your colleagues and your supervisors. Finally, I'm going to wrap up with a story that is another report from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. They've released another report, and this is being reported in the Denver Post, along with the Associated Press, that the Bureau of Labor Statistics looks at about 233,000 additional jobs opening up for registered nurses each year. That's each year through 2016. Now, here we are, 2009. We're looking 7 to 8 years down the road, having new nursing positions being available to the tune of 233,000. That's in addition to what's already in place. And that's something that we need to consider as we continue to support nurse staffing initiatives, as we continue to support nursing education initiatives, and quite frankly, as we continue to figure out how the heck we're going to take care of our patients, because let's look at it. We're going to have more patients and not less patients in the next 7 years as our population continues to age and as our aging population has the health issues that go along with aging. We are going to have more patients to care for, more patients with chronic illnesses, and so we need to really look at a lot of things when we think about caring for those patients over the next 7 to 10 years. One of the things that leaps to mind immediately to me is looking for ways to reduce that patient load by improving initiatives to deal with health issues now. And that's something I'm a big proponent of, getting patients care and to deal with their chronic problems or their chronic risk factors before they become an illness that requires regular hospitalization or regular treatment and more nursing care. So let's look at that and let's examine it. Let's get together with that first article I talked about with nursing research. These things tie hand in hand. And remember, it takes 5 to 7 years to get research out there that actually can be implemented. So we need to start now. We can't just wait. So if you have had an idea of a way to impact nursing care, if you've had an idea to impact the quality of using your facility as an educational resource for new and upcoming nurses, we should be implementing those programs immediately. Don't just sit there and sit back and think on them. Put together a program in your facility or in your community where nurses get together and brainstorm on ways to improve access for new students to enter the nursing profession. I think that this is something that every single community, big and small, can and should do, and you will be surprised at the amount of resources that might become available to you when you publicize something like that. There are offices, facilities, hospitals, and other businesses that are tied directly to our ability to provide quality care, and those businesses, facilities, and offices are certainly going to be interested in supplying for the nursing profession and the nursing workforce in years to come. So we can certainly reach out to them. That's a look at the news this week. Remember, there's links to all of these stories in the show notes at nursingshow.com, and that's all in the podcast category. So you can head over there and check that out. Jump on into this week's tip and trick of the week. And we're going to be joined here in just a second with an interview I recorded with Lisa Booz. She's a pharmacist over at Maryland Poison Center. And you can find their information at mdpoison.com. And they have great resources, a newsletter with a monthly submission of tox tidbits that is in addition to what you'd hear here. And you can sign up for that whether you live in the state of Maryland or not. So head on over to mdpoison.com, sign up for the tox tidbits newsletter, and all of the additional information you can find over there. Hi, this is Jamie Davis, the PodMedic, and it's time for another Tox Tidbits segment with our friend Lisa Booz from the Maryland Poison Center. And it's cold weather time, and a lot of people are checking the antifreeze levels in their cars, and maybe that antifreeze is sitting out, or a child or a pet gets into that substance, and that could cause a problem. Can it, Lisa?
It certainly can. It certainly can. And I'd like your listeners to just imagine for a moment about a case that we hear about a lot. Just imagine that you eradicate it. He has a long history of ethanol abuse, but he denies drinking any alcohol for the past day. His heart rate's 120, his blood pressure's 110 over 70, respirations are 24. Suddenly, his level of consciousness declines further. He needs to be intubated. And when he gets to the hospital or later on in the hospital, labs show that he has a very profound metabolic acidosis, but his ethanol level zero. So what's going on? Well, that case is a real good example of an antifreeze ingestion. And many antifreeze ingestions go unrecognized initially because they appear to be just that the patient is drunk or that they've been that they're chronic alcohol abusers. But each year there are more than 7,000 antifreeze exposures reported to poison centers in the United States. Ingestions can occur as a result of a small child unintentionally drinking the liquid. It could be as a result of a suicide attempt. But also we see a lot of antifreeze being used as an alcohol substitute. Ethylene glycol and methanol are the most commonly used chemicals in antifreeze. They're the two that are of the greatest concern. And they're also called toxic alcohols. You might see that terminology. Ethylene glycol is a sweet, odorless liquid. It's also found in automobile coolants, brake fluids, and also some glass cleaners. Methanol is more commonly found in automobile windshield washer fluid, but it's also encountered in model airplane fuel, cooking fuels such as Sterno, and there are other brands of that. Dry gas, and also fluid for photocopiers. Now, ingestions of even very, very small amounts are almost always a medical emergency. A lethal dose of ethylene glycol is as little as 1.5 milliliters per kilogram, and 1 milliliter per kilogram of methanol is considered lethal. Now, that's a tablespoonful in a toddler. So toxic amount would be even less than that, but a lethal amount could be as little as a tablespoonful in a small child. Both alcohols are absorbed very rapidly out of the GI tract when ingested, but patients often are asymptomatic for a period of hours, or they might complain just of a little bit of nausea, a little bit of an upset stomach. The ethylene glycol and the methanol themselves are really not very toxic, but both are metabolized by the liver to toxic compounds. Ethylene glycol is metabolized to some compounds called glycolate, oxalate, and other acids. And methanol is converted to formic acid. And it's the accumulation of all of these acids in both cases that produces the severe toxicity. Now, all alcohols, including ethylene glycol and methanol, produce inebriation and lethargy. And as the acid metabolites from ethylene glycol start to sort of build up and exert their toxic effects, that's when we see this metabolic acidosis. Their pHs are very low. And they also may develop tachycardia, arrhythmias, and pulmonary edema. Then about 24 to 72 hours later, kidney failure occurs. Now, methanol also produces a severe metabolic acidosis, but we don't see the renal failure with methanol like we do with ethylene glycol. But what we do see with methanol are visual disturbances. Patients often describe their vision as like walking in a snowstorm. It's almost like a complete whiteout eventually, and permanent vision loss or blindness is possible. As far as treatment, the ABCs are very critical to managing patients, and especially since some will present later in the course with severe symptoms. They don't necessarily come to the hospital or call 911 right away. Because both of these alcohols are absorbed very rapidly, and because there is a delay often before seeking medical treatment, attempts at trying to empty the stomach or using activated charcoal really are of no benefit, and so we don't recommend anything like that as far as treating the patient. We will recommend sodium bicarbonate to reverse the metabolic acidosis. Hemodialysis can be used to remove the acid metabolites, and that's also useful if the patient's in renal failure. But there are two antidotes, actually, for these antifreeze agents. One is ethanol, believe it or not, and one is famotidine. Ethanol has been used for many years as an antidote because it actually inhibits or stops the metabolism of the antifreeze to those toxic metabolites or acids. But ethanol is very difficult to use. It's almost impossible to correctly dose the patient because everyone eliminates ethanol at different rates. So it's really almost a trial and error when dosing it, whether it's given orally or IV. Underdosing often occurs, especially in patients who are used to drinking ethanol, and that can result in ineffectiveness as an antidote. Also, we have to check blood ethanol levels every 2 hours to make sure that we're dosing the antidote properly. And we have to frequently adjust the dose, and that leads to a lot of errors, a lot of opportunities to miscalculate doses and to not administer it properly. And as we all know, ethanol can be toxic. You know, as a matter of fact, the amount of ethanol required to be used as an antidote in this case will produce intoxication. So the patient often becomes lethargic and they can develop respiratory depression because of the antidote that we're given. Lastly, ethanol really isn't FDA approved for antifreeze poisonings, even though we've used it for many, many years. Now, fortunately, a newer antidote, which is called famotidine, was approved by the FDA in 1997 for ethylene glycol poisoning and also in 2000 for methanol poisoning, and it's sold under the brand name Antizol. Like ethanol, it also blocks the metabolism to those toxic acids, but it's much easier to dose. There's no need to monitor blood levels of the antidote, and it doesn't produce toxic effects like ethanol does. It's usually given IV twice a day for maybe 48 hours or longer, and because it's so effective, sometimes we actually can avoid utilizing hemodialysis in patients. So it's a lot easier on the patient, and it cuts down on hospital costs as well. It's also recommended that patients who ingest antifreeze be given what we call cofactors, and that stimulates the conversion of the acids to non-toxic compounds. And what we generally give are vitamins. For ethylene glycol, we give thiamine and pyridoxine, and for methanol, we give folic acid. Now, one of the big challenges when we're treating these patients is that it's often difficult to diagnose a person who's ingested antifreeze. They often appear intoxicated without a history of drinking antifreeze, and serum concentrations of both of these alcohols or these antifreeze agents are not available in most hospitals. And so it requires sending the blood to outside labs, and that'll delay the diagnosis even further. Because of the severity of the poisoning, we don't want to delay treatment waiting for blood levels to come back. So we always recommend starting the antidote promptly if we even suspect that there might be antifreeze involved. What we can do sometimes is actually look at the urine microscopically if we suspect ethylene glycol, and we may see oxalate crystals, little crystals in the urine. And so that sometimes will help to diagnose the patient. It's not always the case, but sometimes it will help. And also, fluorescein is often added to antifreeze, giving it sort of a bright greenish glow or color. And so sometimes that fluorescein comes out in the urine, and the urine will actually fluoresce. And so that helps to identify the antifreeze. But all of these markers really are not foolproof because there are also a lot of false negatives. So I strongly recommend calling the poison control center in your area for help in diagnosing and assessing possible antifreeze ingestions, because it is one poisoning in particular that is very, very severe. Fatalities are likely to occur if they're not diagnosed and treated properly. And a lot of patients do come in without a history of drinking antifreeze. So call the Poison Center. The phone number is 1-800-222-1222, and the poison specialist would be more than happy to help treat these patients, help diagnose these patients.
Lisa, what about the so-called safe antifreeze, green antifreezes that you hear about that they're supposed to be more environmentally friendly? Are these still contain toxic substances?
They generally contain a different type of alcohol, usually propylene glycol, which is much, much less toxic. And we do generally call it a non-toxic antifreeze because it really would take a really tremendous amount of that to be toxic, if at all. So definitely those antifreeze agents are much safer to use, particularly if it's around pets or small children in the home. The greenish color in any of these antifreeze agents is usually the fluorescein that's added to it, and that's to help the mechanic or the person working on their car at home to detect a leak of the antifreeze. So the greenish color is usually not because of the antifreeze itself. It's because of the color that's added to it for detection.
Well, it's great information, and it brings to mind, especially in cases of ingestion by people who may not have a specific history of antifreeze ingestion, that we really need to be good detectives, and especially in pre-hospital provider settings, really take a good look around the environment to see if there may be a suspected ingestion of antifreeze, and bring the container along to make sure that we get the correct brand name and concentration levels.
That's right. That would be very helpful if we had the container when we're trying to diagnose and assess the patients. And again, I just want to also bring to light that a lot of antifreeze is actually being used as alcohol substitute. So there are certain populations of people who might be more at risk for antifreeze ingestions than others.
Great, Lisa. Well, thanks a lot, and we'll look forward to your next segment.
Thanks, Jamie.
Thanks again to Lisa. And just another reminder, you can contact your local poison center here in the U.S. at 1-800-222-1222. And that call can be handled by you. It can be handled by your patients, so you can spread the word around about that resource. It is a great resource. There are trained RNs or pharmacists usually at the other end of that line. So you're really getting a medical professional, and you're getting someone that can support you in your patient care and support your patients at home as well. That's going to wrap up another episode of The Nursing Show. I want to thank Lisa Boos for joining us again from the Maryland Poison Center. Also, I want to thank you for listening to the show, and urge you to head over and check out all of the links and resources for this episode and all of the other episodes. You'll find them over at nursingshow.com. In addition, you'll find a lot of other articles and resources and links put up throughout the course of each week, so you'll want to make a point to head back and visit often. If you'd like to become a guest writer for The Nursing Show, we'd certainly love to have you. So if you have a topic in nursing or healthcare in general that you'd like to talk about, or something you're passionate about, certainly contact us. You can reach us at our email address, comments@nursingshow.com. For all kinds of reasons, such as comments on this episode, corrections if we've misspoken in some way. We certainly want to make sure we get the best information out there, as well as requests to become a guest blogger or guest writer here on The Nursing Show. Time to wrap up the show. We'll close out with a song from one of our longtime artists and partners here on the show, Johanna Staley. And this is her song, Nothing I Would Change About You, one of my favorites, and you've probably heard it before if you've been listening to the show for a while. In the meantime, check out Johanna's site. There's a link in the show notes, and let her know you heard it here on The Nursing Show. That's it for me. I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I want to remind all of you to remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care. My car and my shoes.
change a thing.